This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There's highfalutin economics all over the broadcast today. What the Economics Nobel Prize means out in the real world. And a chat with Paul Volcker. Yes, that Paul Volcker. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by American Express Bank, FSB, offering high-yield savings accounts designed with convenient features to help reach savings goals. To learn more or open an account online, visit personalsavings.com/savings. Member FDIC.
From the studios of KERA in Dallas, Texas, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 15th of October. Good to have you here, as always. And you know that supply-demand thing, that matching of buyers and sellers in the marketplace that makes, you know, economics work? That right there, it's worth a Nobel Prize if you figure it out. The 2012 Bank of Sweden Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics has gone to two Americans, Alvin Roth and Lloyd Shapley, for what's commonly known as market theory. Officially, it's called the theory of stable allocations and the practice of market design. And yes, I hear you saying it right now. Real world, please, uses for all that jargon? Oh, we got plenty, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Matching theory is the economics of choice when you aren't the only one choosing. At a press conference earlier today at Stanford University, economist Alvin Roth said his theory applies to people's lives in all kinds of ways, helping them solve problems.
When they get into schools, when they choose careers, when they get married, these are all matching markets. They're markets where you can't just choose what you want, but you also have to be chosen.
Roth's theories have been used to help match kids with public schools, medical students with residencies, and kidney patients with living donors. Ruth Ann Hanto is program manager for UNOS, a kidney donation program. She's worked with Roth for years.
There have been almost 2,000 kidney transplants, and none of this would have been possible without Al's work.
Hanto says kidney patients would often have willing donors, but sometimes those donors weren't a match because of blood type, for example. Roth's work enabled transplant centers to pair up the willing donor and the patient in need.
And the program matches the incompatible donor with a recipient who they're compatible with, and then that person's donor with another recipient who they're compatible with. And so all the donors get to donate, all the recipients get to receive a kidney.
But matching theory applies to all kinds of things, great and small, says Christopher Whalen, senior managing director at Tangent Capital Partners.
The utility of matching is that you are defining a relationship and you're saying to people who may either have whatever it is or need it, we have a way of putting it together. It's like online dating.
This will be
Whalen says whether it be Everlasting Love on eHarmony or Everlast Boxing Gloves, matching theory applies. Like if you type boxing gloves into Google or Amazon, they will match you up with companies that want to sell them to you.
That's a revolutionary thing.
And pure economics. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Real world, just like I promised. So if you listened real closely, you could hear the 1980s in the corporate story of this Monday. Echoes of Japanese companies fixing their sights on American firms. Today, Japan's third largest mobile phone network, a company called SoftBank, said it's going to spend $20 billion in a deal to buy a controlling stake in Sprint Nextel, which happens to be America's number three cell phone company. It would be the biggest overseas acquisition ever by a Japanese firm, and the deal bears the imprint of an ambitious and uncommon Japanese CEO, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
SoftBank's chief executive, Masayoshi Son, is sort of like a Japanese version of Virgin's Richard Branson, entrepreneurial, brash, and quixotic. Japan's second richest man, Son founded SoftBank as a computer software wholesaler and transformed it into a major telecom company. Now he set his ambitious sights on the U.S. Masayoshi Son was quoted on the Sprint deal saying, "A man must not settle for being number two. You must aspire to be number one." So will the merger of two third-place companies push either into the number one position?
I don't think that SoftBank has any real shot at becoming the largest wireless carrier either in the U.S. or in Japan.
Michael Hodel is Associate Director of Research at Morningstar.
The companies that they compete against are very formidable and have very deep pockets and massive resources, whether you're talking about NTT Docomo in Japan or AT&T and Verizon Wireless here in the U.S.
Maybe number one is too much to ask for, considering that Sprint is saddled with billions of dollars in debt. Gary Huffbauer is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
Sprint needed to find some kind of alliance to survive, say, for another decade. It could end up being a first-rate player 10 years from now.
The $20 billion investment will allow Sprint to buy rival companies. More important, Huffbauer says, the proposed deal is a huge vote of confidence in the U.S. economy. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, not a bad start to the week, if I say so myself, and I do. Details, numbers, when we get there. If you live in a swing state, doesn't really matter which one, but we'll pick Iowa, it means never-ending television campaign ads, lots of attention from the candidates, and dozens of campaign offices all over the state. You might think that all that activity would be great news for the local economy, right? Well, you'd be wrong, as Iowa Public Radio's Sarah McCammon explains.
We'll get you set up in just a second.
It's a chilly Saturday morning, and volunteers are filing into President Obama's campaign headquarters in Mason City's quaint downtown. Just under 30,000 people live here.
So the purpose of this training is kind of to give you a sense of what your role is in the larger organization of the campaign. So
it's places like these where the ground game in the presidential election is being fought hard in swing states, with volunteers knocking on doors and distributing signs on their candidates' behalf. But does this lead to big sales for Iowa businesses? Are busy campaign volunteers spending money on things like office supplies and coffee?
I'm Catherine Fields. I'm the owner of Coffee Cat here in Mason City.
Fields' coffee shop is around the corner from the Obama office. She gets some traffic from interns, and she sold a few lattes to reporters passing through town to cover political events.
I can find that there's a little more traffic on those days. Yeah, later part of the weeks especially, you know, if there's candidates traveling through the North Iowa area.
But Fields says it's not enough extra business to make a major impact. Ask both campaigns, and they say it's important to have a presence in key parts of Iowa where polls continue to be tight. But they'll acknowledge they're not exactly bringing in big dollars. Aaron Seidler is communications director for Obama's Iowa campaign, which has 67 offices across Iowa, many in small towns.
We think it's important to have a storefront with signs in the window, lights on, and people working as an, you know, as a good face to the community of this campaign and an easy way for people to come volunteer for the campaign.
The Romney campaign has 13 local offices spread across Iowa. Tom Zold is the Iowa spokesman for the Republican National Committee. He says workers are mostly spending money on food and caffeine.
In Mason City, there's a Jimmy John's that's close to the office, and I know that the staffers there run out to Jimmy John's often, as do the volunteers. You know, they're making calls all day. They want to keep making calls, and they run out and grab a quick sandwich and bring it back.
Well, thank you for your time, and you have a blessed day.
Neither campaign would let me interview local office staff on tape. But they did let me talk to volunteers like Darla Connell, a 66-year-old retired John Deere employee. She's among a handful of volunteers, all older women, making phone calls at the Romney office.
One of our favorite restaurants is Jimmy John's, and it's new to this community. They have wonderful food and great service.
Of course, Romney has repeatedly referred to the restaurant chain in stump speeches as an example of American success.
We deliver today to the guys out there.
Earlier in the week.
The Mason City Jimmy John's is just down the street from the Romney office.
Workers Linda Harder and Leah Biebesheimer say they've taken orders from both campaigns, including Obama's. But does that increase business at the store?
I don't think so. I mean, it's just a regular order.
Well, we need to be careful not to confuse the appearance of economic activity with the reality of economic activity.
Economist David Swenson of Iowa State University says even in battleground states like Iowa, most of the campaign spending goes to TV ads, not small businesses. And Swenson says the handful of local staffers who are on the payroll are trained primarily in one thing.
Organizing, organizing, organizing. And the word organizing means get free labor.
Free labor from local residents who would be buying things in their towns anyway. In Mason City, Iowa, I'm Sarah McCammon for Marketplace.
Let's say, just, you know, for the sake of argument and for the purposes of setting up this next interview, too, that you're the president of the United States and you find yourself in something of an economic bind. Being the president, you can call pretty much anybody you want to ask him to come help you out. So you pick up the phone, you have the White House operator call Paul Volcker. He's worked for five presidents, Democrats and Republicans. He is the guy who most famously tamed inflation that was running at a what now seems amazing 13.5% back in the early 1980s. He's also the subject of a new biography by financial historian William Silber called, appropriately enough, Paul Volcker. We have them both in our New York studios. Gentlemen, good to have you with us.
Nice to be with you at a distance.
Nice to be here as well.
Mr. Volcker, why is it that presidents keep calling you and saying, help me out? I mean, President Obama did it. Everybody does it.
Well, I'm not so sure everybody does it. You know, I was around for a while, and I guess it had a certain reputation. I inspired Mr. Silber to decide he wanted to write a book. So maybe Mr. Silber can explain that.
Well, what do you think, Bill Silber? I mean,
they trust him. They get some reflected credibility. Mm. And I think that's not just true of presidents. Even the baseball commissioner called on him to provide the same kind of credibility, and so did the United Nations.
Well, Mr. Volcker, let me ask you, how does it feel to be the guy who was perhaps not as popular while he was in office, but you've had quite the second act?
I was pretty popular by the time I left office. But
by the time you left. But while you were there, you were doing things that didn't make a whole lot of people really happy.
At the beginning, that's right.
I talked to former President Carter a couple of years ago, and I asked him about you and him appointing you to this job. And here's what he said. Let's play that tape.
That was really, though, one of the most hotly debated things I did, because a lot of my political advisors said, don't appoint Paul Volcker because he's going to tighten up on everything and you will have no control at all over the Fed anymore.
That's pretty much it, right? I mean, you went in there, and if I read the recounting of that job interview correctly in this book, you basically said, I want independence and I got to do what I got to do.
Well, it was obvious why he wanted to see me, but I said, Mr. President, if you're thinking of appointing me chairman of the Federal Reserve, you have to know that I believe in a somewhat tighter monetary policy than we have been following and that my predecessor followed.
Yeah, you know, the next question I asked the president, actually, was, did you mind when he raised interest rates like that? And he said, oh, no, I thought it was going to be good for the next presidential term. I just thought that term was going to be mine, not Reagan.
No, I asked him once, did I cost him the election, as some people said, and he had kind of a wry smile, and he said, well, I think there were a few other factors as well.
Yeah. Mr. Volcker, let me ask you what you think then. I mean, inflation we know is a big concern of yours, but what is the biggest economic worry right now? What's your biggest monster under the bed?
Well, the big economic worry now is not just the economic performance of the United States, but that this poor performance ranges right around the world. We have had a lack of discipline in economic policy making, and the over-indebtedness of the American economy, particularly of consumers, is something you can't cure in a hurry.
Part of getting out of this financial crisis, or more importantly, not letting one happen again, is the Dodd-Frank financial reform bill in general, and then specifically this thing that has come to be called the Volcker Rule. It has your name on it, which would prevent the big investment banks from—
The big commercial banks.
Yeah, the big commercial banks, from trading on their own account. Are you satisfied that that will keep things from getting worse again?
No, that's one element in an overall reform program, and maybe because it's got a name on it, people interpret this, in my view, as being this is the key to the future. This is one element in a needed reform.
Mr. Volker, last question before I let you go. One of the big things the next president's going to have to do, whoever that turns out to be, is appoint a successor to Mr. Bernanke. Thoughts on, if not a specific name, then what qualities that person ought to have?
Well, you would look for somebody that had some experience, I think, in the world of finance and the world of business.
No. I'm interrupting. Backbone.
I was going to get there eventually.
Well, it took you too long. It took you too long. Backbone.
You're right. I'll accept that.
Paul Volcker is, of course, Paul Volcker. He's the subject of a new biography by William Silber, who's a financial historian and a professor at the Stern School of Business at NYU. Gentlemen, thanks a lot for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
You get Paul Volcker in the studio. Obviously, you talk for more than 4 minutes and 15 seconds or whatever it was. We've got the full interview on our website. It is marketplace.org. Coming up.
They know you in ways that you can't even imagine.
Relax, it's just the movies. How Netflix knows what it knows. But first, yeah, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials put on 95 points today, 0.75%, 13,424 at the bell. The NASDAQ charged up 20 points, 2/3%, settled at 3,064. The S&P 500 added 11 points, 0.8%, 1440. The number there. Good day for financials. Bank of America and Goldman Sachs piled up more than 3.5% apiece. Morgan Stanley added 2.5%. Sprint Nextel dialed down 0.2% after that Japanese telecom firm we told you about agreed to buy a 70% stake in the company. Eli Lilly shot up more than 4% today. The drug maker's stomach cancer drug was tested to help patients live longer. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.67%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by American Express Bank, FSB, offering high-yield savings accounts with a competitive variable interest rate and convenient access via phone or web. Link your existing bank accounts without switching banks. To learn how this FDIC-insured high-yield savings account can complement your savings goals and to open an account online, visit personalsavings.com/savings. Member FDIC.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Labor Department tells whether you and I paid more or less for stuff last month. The Consumer Price Index is released. The Federal Reserve issues its monthly industrial production report. And it's Dictionary Day, celebrated on the anniversary of Noah Webster's birthday. Go look something up. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Well, you can add Ohio to the growing list of states that see dollar signs in their highway systems, big dollar signs, I should say. Governor John Kasich of Ohio says he wants to privatize his state's turnpike, all 241 miles of it. He's going to lease it out to foreign investors. Says Ohio stands to make more than $1 billion on the deal, as Marketplace's David Gura reports.
The Ohio Turnpike gets a lot of traffic. Joshua Shank is the president and CEO of a think tank called the Eno Center for Transportation.
Companies have made location decisions on that basis. Freight has made logistics decisions on the basis of the Ohio Turnpike existing.
If the Turnpike does go private, drivers would still use it, which is why this kind of deal is so attractive to investors. But it doesn't mean those drivers wouldn't be upset. Trevor Brown teaches public policy at Ohio State.
Safe to say that many residents in northern Ohio are skeptical because they fear higher tolls and potentially more potholes.
It costs $16.50 to drive the whole length of the Ohio Turnpike from Pennsylvania to Indiana. If the state does lease it, tolls would probably go up. But Joshua Shank with the Eno Center says that'd be a decision the lessee would make. The governor would be off the hook.
It's a lot easier to go to the people of the state and say, look, I just got this huge amount of cash for this asset and that we can now use for all the things that we want, than it is to go to them and say, hey, I need you to pay more for this road, so I'm going to increase the tolls.
Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels privatized the Indiana Toll Road. The former mayor of Chicago leased the Chicago Skyway to the same investors. In that case, there was pushback. The money didn't go toward improving transportation. Shank says you got to remember something.
The deal that's made will determine for a long period of time the winners and losers.
Those leases in Chicago and Indiana are 99-year deals. A formal proposal from Governor Kasich is expected next month. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
I'm going to guess pretty much all of you have at least heard of Netflix. Those little red DVD mailers were everywhere for a good 10 years or so. Now, customers are just as likely to stream Netflix movies as they are to order an actual DVD in the mail. But the point is, the company is bigger than ever. Its co-founder, Reed Hastings, gets most of the press. But there is another guy who was present at the creation of that company that you don't hear a lot about. His name is Mark Randolph. And in her new book, it's called Netflixed, The Epic Battle for America's Eyeballs, author Gina Keating tracked him down. Gina, it's good to have you with us.
Nice to be here, Kai.
Mark turns out to be this customer service guy. Reed Hastings is the guy who made the signature thing about Netflix work, those algorithms that get you the ideas for movies that you might want to see.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the interface, the consumer-facing part of Netflix, which we all love and makes us feel like we're having a conversation with the company, was really Mark Randolph's idea. And Reed is just an absolutely brilliant mathematician, and he was able to boil down human behavior into algorithms. And that all proved to be incredibly critical when they got into this big price war with Blockbuster, because they had to bring their prices down as low as possible and really cut their cost in order to run against a huge rival like Blockbuster.
Is it right that Reed Hastings at one point said, I will lose money for as long as it takes to drive Blockbuster and Walmart and everybody else out of this business so that I can own it?
Yes, he did. He said that to me. And I was interviewing him shortly after he had said to a very upset Wall Street and investors, we're going to run it break even because I'm going to plow every single dollar of that I make back into the business. And I'm going to make my subscriber base huge. And it's going to be really expensive for everybody to compete with me. And it's not going to be worth it. Of course, I ran right out of the room and wrote a story about it. And the stock tanked and I felt kind of guilty about it.
But for all of that he had and for all of his gut intuition being right, I have to now at this point bring up this thing called Quickster, that move he made last year to separate the streaming video business and the DVD mailer business and the brouhaha is the polite word for what happened after that. I mean, he got clobbered.
Yes, he did. And that's the other side to being very headstrong and sure that you're right, is that sometimes you're not. And He has been described to me, and I say this in the book, as a guy who is incredibly brilliant about engineering, about mathematics. He's not a real people person. Mm. He's not empathetic. He doesn't really understand consumers that well. But he does have a lot of data to show what they're likely to do. And he knew that eventually people were going to stop wanting to have DVDs delivered by mail. And so he just thought, well, maybe I'll just nudge people along to get them out of this DVD by mail business so I can go towards streaming and really optimize that.
Right. First mover advantage, though, right, which is what they have, goes away over time as people with more money and more oomph come in.
You would think that. The other thing they have going for them is that website is a highly instrumented market research platform. They have 15 years of data about consumers, and their projections are amazing. They can figure out, you know, when you stop a movie, what scenes you like, what actors you don't like, when you like to watch TV, when you're, you know, more likely to do, you know, three or four shows at a time. So they know you in ways that you can't even imagine. And that, to me, was a little bit strange. But, you know, I guess maybe we should just put it down to having a good experience.
Horrifying, hello? I mean, come on.
Yeah, maybe a little.
The book by Gina Keating is called Netflixed, about the company of almost the same name. The subtitle is The Epic Battle for America's Eyeballs. Gina, thanks a bunch. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Kai.
You know those calorie counts that are posted on menus in a lot of states now? Well, they are coming soon to a soda vending machine near you. Starting next year, Coke, Pepsi, Dr. Pepper, and Snapple are all going to put the ugly truth right there on the buttons on those machines. It is a healthy move, perhaps, but commentator Beth Tytel says all this disclosure is getting a little hard to swallow.
There are some things you just don't want to know. The size of your friend's bonus, the origin of that sticky stuff on the kitchen floor, and the calorie count of the brownie you grabbed as you were paying for a salad with that low-fat dressing. But enjoy that brownie in blissful ignorance while you can, because the calorie cops are on the move. Vending machines will now show how many calories are in that Coke, and restaurant chains are going to have to post how many calories in your burger or in your latte as early as next year. Oh, great. I know the government's trying to help, but here's the question. Is our weight problem really caused by a lack of information? I doubt it. As the amount of data has ballooned, so have Americans. In 1990, when the U.S. Food and Drug Administration began requiring almost all packaged foods to carry nutritional information, fewer than one in four adults were obese. Now, when even McDonald's openly posts calories, more than a third of us are. No one has the chutzpah to claim that labeling causes obesity, not even the soft drink makers or restaurant interests. But as Seinfeld fans will recall, dieters can get lulled into a false sense of security.
Hey, this yogurt is really something, huh? And it's non-fat! I've been waiting for something like this my whole life, and it's finally here!
Jerry and Elaine packed on the pounds after binging on frozen yogurt that falsely declared itself fat-free. And in a frightening case of life-imitating sitcom, a study of dozens of restaurants found that the calorie counts for diet dishes were too low by an average of 100 calories. I'd be willing to overlook that, but my genes aren't equally forgiving. To be fair, all this calorie labeling has made me change my behavior. It's driving me to eat foods that keep their bad news to themselves. These days, I get candy from the dish on a colleague's desk, not the vending machine. A head-in-the-sand approach? Perhaps. But think about this. When Wile E. Coyote runs off a cliff, he doesn't fall until he looks down.
Takes me straight back to Saturday mornings, that sound does. Beth Tytel is a reporter for the Boston Globe. Her book is called Drinking Problems at the Fountain of Youth.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, just to get you prepped for the presidential debate tomorrow night. Time magazine has posted online the 21-page, yes, 21-page, memorandum of understanding between the two campaigns and the Commission on Presidential Debates. There's nothing in there, sadly, about chilled Evian water in the waiting rooms or colored M&Ms, but it is still a pretty good read. Specific forms of address required, Mr. President and Governor Romney only, please. No moving from behind one's respective podiums. Television cameras may tilt or rotate, but otherwise will be locked down. That's actually what it says. Does strike one as kind of silly. Anyway, you should read them yourself. It's pretty interesting. Marketplace.org is the website. And that is Marketplace, the radio show from American Public Media. Today, the Dow closed up 95 points, about 0.75%. The NASDAQ up 20 points, 0.67%. The S&P 500 tacked on about 12 points, 0.8%. Our producers include Bridget Bonner, Gina Delvac, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Megan Larson, Liza Madry, Joel Patterson, and Jolie Podokas. Thanks today to the staff here at KERA in Dallas. I will see you back in Los Angeles tomorrow. See ya. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.